We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara,
me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me,
and me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons and Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All
pelicans
all the time.
Welcome to the show. This is part two of our podcast extravaganza. The first part was, of course, about Michael and I talking about our big boards and the players on them. And this is to get a different perspective from former scout from the NBA.
And now we're joined by Amin El-Hassan, who is the former assistant director of basketball operations for the Phoenix Suns. And now he writes for ESPN. Amin, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
We basically brought you on because we've been having our argument for the past few weeks about, you know, what the Pelicans should be taking at spot number six in this draft. And there are some guys we love and some guys we hate. And since we're, you know, far from experts, though we like to pretend we are, we decided we might need an actual expert on the podcast. So Michael has a few guys he wanted to hit you up particularly about. So, Michael, have at him.
Yeah, Michael Carter-Williams in the expert mock draft on ESPN, you had Phoenix taking him at five. He's a guy that I've heard you say and write that you like in this draft. Obviously, the Pelicans have a need at point guard. It seems like he's your favorite point guard in the draft. If I'm the GM of the Pelicans, how would you sell me on taking Michael Carter-Williams at six?
Well, first of all, I think when you look at this draft, we have a lot of players who will be contributors, I think, in the league over the next few years, more so than maybe your average draft. On the flip side, we don't have too many players who have the upside or potential to be kind of superstar players or dominant at their position in some way or another. There are a couple who kind of may have a window of opportunity there, and I think Michael Carter-Williams is one of those guys. When you talk about a 6'6 point guard, a 6'6 pass first point guard, your mind automatically races to, you know, the great names have come before him around that size. When you talk about Magic at 6'9, you talk about Penny Hardaway at 6'7, you know, even a guy like Sean Livingston before he got hurt, Steve Smith before he was converted into a shooting guard. A lot of great players. When you talk about size at that position, that's something very special because it doesn't come along that often, particularly with his kind of athleticism and explosiveness. So, you know, as far as for the Hornets, I love Vasquez. I love Grievous Vasquez. He's a plucky player, but he has his limitations. And I think when you bring in a guy like Carter Williams, the vision would be ultimately maybe those two guys playing side by side, switching off just as a pair of guards, as opposed to one guy being a point guard, one guy being the shooting guard. But ultimately, you know, that's a position of need for them. They need a point guard who's a little bit more dynamic. I love Carter Williams. I think he'd be a great fit for New Orleans.
Yeah, and I mean, I get what you're saying about the size, and I'm not going to try to beat up and rehash the, well, he can't shoot argument, because, you know, I think almost everybody would agree that that's the skill, you know, that a player can most likely improve upon. What I'm scared about, honestly, with Carter Williams is you talk about his size, and that's supposed to be an advantage, you know, particularly around the rim. But even though he's bigger than the other point guards in this draft, he's the worst finisher at the rim in half-court possessions. He finishes at the rim less than 49% of the time. I mean, you take the high turnover ratio and the poor jump shot, and you say, maybe we could fix that. But the fact that even though he is tall, he can't finish at the rim, wouldn't that scare you as well as an executive?
Yes and no. I think, you know, finishing is also something that is a learned trait. And I also think that, you know, when you talk about a guy's stats in college, you know, that's one of those things where it really will vary. When you think about Michael Carter Williams driving to the hole at Syracuse, it was either, you know, try and finish or dump it off to who? You know, I like CJ Fair, but, you know, he's not striking fear in the hearts of men. It's a big difference when you're Mike Carter Williams. Now you got Anthony Davis right there, you know, or even a guy, you know, Robin Lopez, who's got some length and is a pretty good finisher around the rim, or maybe even kicking it all the way cross court to Ryan Anderson for a corner three. You know, those options are a lot better than the options that he had at Syracuse. So that in turn forces the defense to react more to his drives, which in turn opens up easier layup opportunities.
And so from your point of view, I mean, you did some scouting when you were with Phoenix. When you're looking at a guy who plays primarily in the 2-3 zone, I mean, are you just figuring that pretty much every 19, 20-year-old that comes into the NBA is going to come in with poor defensive principles, so it doesn't matter? Or, you know, are there pluses and minuses in a guy playing primarily zone in college?
Well, you know, there's two sides of it. The one side is, like you mentioned, most of these kids don't know what they're doing defensively when they come in. Part of that is due to lack of knowledge of personnel. Part of it is due to college did not prepare them correctly in terms of defensive principles, and part of it is they weren't tested. A lot of nights you could take the night off, or you could go 50% and still be pretty good defensively. Having said that, there is something about Syracuse guys that makes them less than desirable on the defensive end. Let's say that. I mean, it's a long history. It goes back a long, long time. You know, and you know, it sounds kind of lazy to just, oh, it's because of the 2-3 zone. Because you would think that would encourage more awareness, team defensive principle, being able to move on a string, which is kind of where the NBA defenses have gone recently. But it seems to have done the opposite. Most of those guys come, and they're lazy, they're not reactive. You know, I think about a guy like Johnny Flynn, who was, we call him a traffic cop. He does a really good job of pointing at the ball, but never really actually reacts to get in front of the ball or move his feet or anything. So when I look at Mike Carter Williams, I see someone who's probably one of the best defensive players that Syracuse has ever seen on the perimeter. I thought him, Trish, and then Deion Waiters last year did a really good job of being aggressive out of a defensive set that's typically the opposite of aggressive. Like, you think about 2-3 zone is waiting for you to take a bad shot. But those guys are really good at trapping the ball and getting after it on the perimeter. So I'm encouraged by that, but at the same time, I'd be lying to you if I didn't think, well, he is a Syracuse guy. I mean, that is in the back of my head.
So the other guy in the top six that absolutely scares me are guys projected to go that high. Another guy that I've heard that you seem to like, an Anthony Bennett. I guess my biggest issue with him is the last 3 years of his career, in seasons in which he's only had to play 30 to 40 games, he's had pretty major injuries in all three of those years. Now, you know, Phoenix obviously had some interest in Eric Gordon last year. You know, it seems like some teams are less scared off by this than others, but when a guy has what looks like an injury history, how do you factor that in? I mean, even if he's healthy now or projects to be healthy in 2 or 3 months, is there a belief in some front offices that some guys' bodies just can't handle the 82 game grind? And if so, you know, how do you go about deciding whether a guy like Anthony Bennett is one of those guys, or if it's just a fluke that he's gotten injured the last 3 years?
All right, well, first of all, you talk about Phoenix being interested in Eric Gordon. That's called desperation. let's not confuse that with any sort of logical decision-making. Like, well, that's just people who are desperate for talent. That's what happens when you're not successful for as long as they haven't been successful. when you talk about in the draft, however, I think, you know, first of all, we got to accept that everyone's different. You know, there are different cases all along. You definitely trust your medical personnel. For us in Phoenix, we put a lot of trust in our training staff. Our head trainer, Aaron Nelson, could usually watch a guy and tell you why he was the way he was. Oh, yeah, he's running this way, so that means his hip flexors are too tight. You know, if we just, you know, the best example I give you is Shaq. When we acquired Shaq, you know, before we acquired him, we consulted a training staff. And at the time, people don't remember this, everyone said Shaq was going to retire. He was just so hurt, and, he was basically a dead body. And we showed Aaron Nelson the film and said, what do you think? Does this look like it's something that's career ending, or can we fix him? And he watched like 15 minutes. Like, oh yeah, he's all right. He's just, you know, and he starts going out all these body parts. Oh, his hip flexors are a little tight. And then, you know, you do this, we get him so corrected. But I said, 6 weeks, he'll be fine. Well, he was back in like 3, working with those guys. And then, wow. And the next year he was all-star MVP. You know, and this is a guy whose career was over. You know, he made the all-star game, first of all, and then played well enough to be one of the two best, you know, players in the game. I think Kobe was the other co-MVP. So, you know, that story isn't a referendum on Shaq and his career, but more so about a training staff and putting the trust in them. And if you have a good staff, they can spot these things. And on the flip side, there are times when they're like, stay well away from this guy. It's over for him. You know, I think you've got to put a lot of trust in your medical personnel and in the information that you have. The type of injury, obviously microfracture is one of those ones that has a bad connotation to it. Bennett has a torn rotator cuff, or it's a shoulder injury.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of those ones where the main thing is healing more than anything. It's not rushing back, because it's really easy to re-injure that injury. As far as durability goes, you know, again, you got to look at, are these injuries connected, which often is the case, is that you hurt something, and then you come back too early, or you come back not having fully rehab, so now you're compensating by that injury, and in turn, creating another injury, and so on and so forth. And then there's some guys where it's just bad luck. Greg Oden is that to me. Greg Oden's injuries were just bad luck. Now, obviously, every, you know, rehab is a little bit more effective than the one before it, but, you know, it's a lot of bad luck, I just got to say. You know, I think he was just a terribly unlucky kid. And sometimes that's, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, that's a big part of the whole game, not just injuries, but everything that we do in basketball. So, you know, as far as it goes for Bennett, I think if my doctors tell me that it's all right and my trainers think he'll be all right, I don't think that'll scare me off from taking him.
So the question then about Bennett is, let's say my trainers come back and they say they've looked him over, they think he's going to come out just fine. 3 months from now, he'll be on the basketball court and we'll have no issues. So sell me on Anthony Bennett, because at times the effort just doesn't seem to be there, and that scares me. I could see him turning into Michael Sweetney.
Oh, nah, that's that. Come on, man. that's all tough. Michael Sweetney came in overweight. He came in, you know, not in good shape. And then Michael Sweetney had other issues that we came to find out later. You know, the guy battled depression and all types of things that go well beyond basketball. You know, Bennett, first of all, physically, he's an Adonis. You know, you look at him, he's got a well-built physique. Then from a skill standpoint, I think, you know, although Sweetney was a lot better than people remember from the perimeter, this kid is way better than that. You know, as far as being the player inside and outside, this kid is far beyond that. Questions about the intensity, I think he's just naturally got a calm demeanor. And I think another part of it also is UNLV did not do the best job of showcasing his abilities. And that's a euphemistic way of saying I think they were trying to hide him. That's not me being a source or anything. That's just me watching the kind of talent that they have and the way they use him. And there's either one or two explanations usually for that. The coach doesn't know what he's doing, or the coach is trying to make sure this guy comes back for a second year. I think, you know, I give a lot of credit to the staff at UNLV. I think it was the latter. You know, they didn't want him to look too good because they knew if he did, he'd bolt and probably be a top three pick. Well, the funny thing about NBA talent evaluators is you can usually sniff this stuff out. He's going to be a top three pick anyway, so they could have gotten a lot more out of him. But, I'm not scared away from those things so much as I'm scared away. The negative on my end is he is a tweener. He's not quite a three, and he's not quite a four. And, you know, when you talk about guys who are too small for their position, in our league, that usually ends up being a high-level backup player. Because of the demands of being, you know, of being a starter. When you're undersized, you better be a hell of a ball player to be a starter and help your team win. You know, you can be undersized and be pretty good individually, but from a team, you know, success standpoint, it's a different case. So think about Monte Ellis. He can average 26 points a game as a starter in this league, and there aren't too many guys in the league who can say that. But are you better as a team with Monte Ellis as just starting shooting guard? No. He's probably best suited coming off the bench for someone and being an explosive scorer who just terrorizes second units than he is being a starter and being, you know, a defensive liability and having to build a team that's kind of structured around his size deficiency and those other types of issues. So that's what scares me about Bennett.
So we look at somebody like Otto Porter, and I think the small forwards kind of became the darlings of the playoffs this year in a lot of ways. Whether you're looking at a Kawhi Leonard or a Paul George or a Jimmy Butler, they all kind of came into the spotlight. A big part of which probably because they were defending LeBron and going right back at him. What do you see for Porter and his NBA career? Are we talking about a guy who's likely to be that much better than a Jimmy Butler, a guy who went in the late 20s in another draft? Or, I mean, do you see him kind of being a complementary player along those lines and therefore a guy who might be picked a little later than people are projecting in this draft?
Right. So Porter is one of my favorite players in this draft, but at the same time, he's pretty much the poster child of what this draft is about. Someone, you know, I look at Otto Porter and I say, this is a guy who's going to play in the league as long as his body allows him to. Meaning, if he doesn't get hurt, he's going to be in this league. And he's going to be a contributor. He's going to be a, you know, a starter or a, you know, a rotation player. How good can he be? What's his ceiling? That's the part that I struggle with. Because I think he's going to be a very good complimentary piece. Guy who does all the little things and the dirt work and always on top of his rotations and helps out on the glass and, you know, can guard a versatile, you know, array of different types of players and knock down the open shot and post up when he gets a mismatch and all those types of nice kind of things. But I don't ever see him as the type of player I can give him the ball and say, go get me one, or carry us to a playoff victory or, you know, or a series win or something. I struggle seeing that. And I've talked to scouts that, you know, think of his upside as a poor man Scottie Pippen. Even then, that's a really, really lofty upside for me. Now, I look at him more as a Derek McKee type, and I don't know how old you guys that.
Oh, hey.
I might be dating myself. I don't know, but you know, Derek McKee, obviously with the Sonics, with the Pacers, you know, versatile, really versatile. When you talk about 6'8", 6'9", can handle the ball and shoot and defend and do all these things. But at the same time, you know, he's under the radar guy. You know, he was never the best player on his team, even though he probably had the talent to. He was just kind of a really good complimentary role player, and that's what I see Otto Porter being. You know, Jimmy Butler is a good name. Shane Battier is another good name. You know, these guys that help you win are going to be as a valuable commodity to have. But at the same time, when you talk about, do you draft these guys third overall, second or first overall, as we've heard? You know, probably not. When you talk about the draft, and I think I talked about this on the Draft Insider podcast, but when you talk about picking first, second, or third, you know, something that high, top five, really, but really specifically those one, two, and three, there has to be some potential for this becoming a franchise-altering moment. You know, I don't think you can make a safe pick there because, you know, you have a zillion future drafts to make safe picks. There's a Jimmy Butler in every draft. There is a Jimmy Butler, you know, in that Jimmy Butler range in every draft. It's not that hard to find someone who's 6'6", guards, and can shoot threes. It's not as hard as you think. Maybe they can't shoot threes yet, like Kawhi Leonard in 2011, and it takes him a year to get there. Or you know, maybe he doesn't defend as well as you, or maybe he defends better than you think he does. And, you know, just because he was in college, didn't fully allow him to showcase his defensive ability. But there's a guy like that every draft. Even though Otto Porter is really talented and probably one of the best players and probably one of the best bets in this draft, I just can't justify taking him first overall or second overall because the feeling is, even though I'm way more confident in his ability to turn out than I am in, say, Nerlens Noel, I know that if Nerlens Noel hits, that's the kind of franchise-altering moment that you can't get at a later pick, and you can't get in a future draft or in a future round or anything like that. You know, those are the type of talents that only come by if you're picking here. So, you know, yeah. It's kind of glass half full, half empty, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think one of those guys is in your own backyard, Carrick Felix. I think he's going to be a guy who is going to kind of be the Jimmy Butler of this draft. So I agree.
Let me ask you one question about what you said there was, you don't think that Porter's ever going to be the guy that you can just get the ball to and so say, go get me. Is there a guy in this draft? I mean, Michael and I have thought C.J. McCollum could be that. Is there anybody, would you be comfortable with C.J. McCollum possibly turning into that, saying that? Or is there just nobody in the draft who you can think of that way?
I think C.J. McCollum has as good a chance as anybody, but I think, you know, when you talk about this draft overall, I don't think we're going to have any superstar-type players. I think, you know, you're going to have some players who might be one-time, two-time all-stars, but they're going to be just mainly solid NBA players. Besides McCollum, I'm trying to think who else. You know, I think McLemore has a chance, you know, if he continues to develop his game. as a 19, 20-year-old, you know, shooting the way he does and with his type of athleticism, that I would think that if he wants to work at it, he can become better at creating his own offense. I think Anthony Bennett, because of that, you know, inside-outside game, has a chance to be that kind of player. I think I'm drawing blanks now.
Which gives us a good idea of how shallow this draft is.
And again, I don't like calling it shallow because there's a lot more NBA talent than normal. But when you talk about stars, you know, when you think about last year, and you know, you could just easily rattle off guys like, you know, Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Harrison Barnes and, you know, Damian Lillard. All these guys came top of mind very easily. This draft is, you don't think about it the same way because it's tough to even differentiate. You know, I was talking to a buddy of mine earlier, and I said, the crazy thing is there's not that big a difference between the guy who's going to go 5 and the guy who goes 15, and then the guy who goes 16 and the guy who goes 30, and then the guy who goes 30 and the guy who goes 45. You know, that those from 5 to 45, believe it or not, there's not that big of a difference in talent. It really turns into, you know, flavor. What do you like, you know? What turns you on, you know? And that makes this year tough, but it also makes it kind of interesting because, you know, most of the time, like I said, you know, these guys should go top 7. These guys should go rest of the lottery. These guys will be in the mid-teens. This year is kind of up in the air, you know, past 4 or 5, really.
So this is a draft that people don't think there's going to be stars in. Most seem to agree on that. The consensus seems to be, though, that the 2014 draft could compete someday with the 2003 draft, where we could have a couple of stars come out of there. You know, it seems like almost anybody would trade their pick this year, trade fairly decent assets this year for a 2014 pick. You know, the Pelicans look this summer to be adding some guys, you know, hopefully to become better, get more wins this season, push for the playoffs maybe this year or next. What kind of value do you think an unprotected 2014 first rounder from a team like the Pelicans, who have finished last and second to last in the Western Conference, would have on the trade market if all these reports of, you know, GMs just salivating over this 2014 draft is true?
It all depends on what we're dangling, you know, what we're dangling in return. If I'm looking to give up a player that I believe would change New Orleans' fortunes, you know, I probably would hesitate a little, or I'd wait to the last possible minute before I'd give something up. The 2014 draft is pretty studded, you know, starting with Wiggins and then moving on down to the Harrison twins and, you know, other players that didn't come out this year, you know, from Kentucky that, you know, came back for another year. And but again, you know, when you talk about making a move for a draft pick, you're basically making a bet. You're making two bets. First of all, you're making the bet that the guy that you're giving up wasn't going to help you that much anyway. And then the other bet you're making is, I'm hoping he's not going to help you guys that much either, right? that's really what you do when you ask for picks. Part of it is just you want an asset. You want something to say that we got this and this. But a lot of times you're also like making these bets, like, oh yeah, they're going to be they'll still be terrible 3 years from now. You know, like think about Chicago getting a protected first rounder from Charlotte for Tyrus Thomas. Like that's 100%. You know, look at the protections. Like, don't worry. By the time it's fully unprotected, they'll still be terrible. that's just know that happened right there. So if you talk about an unprotected pick, wholly unprotected, 2014.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, I just watched two straight summers in which an unprotected pick from a bad team, you know, was a foundation piece in a superstar trade. I mean, the Clippers got Chris Paul, and most would say the second biggest piece they gave up in that trade was the unprotected Minnesota pick, which everybody thought was going to be really high. And, you know, last year with James Harden, I think most people would say the second biggest piece, maybe at the, you know, maybe the biggest piece of Kevin Martin leaves, you know, that OKC got for Harden was this unprotected pick. It just seems to me that it's such a seller's market. If you want to trade that pick, that I really think it's something that teams, you know, should explore, because they seem to have a high amount of value, at least these past two summers. And if the Pelicans are banking on that they get better, why not trade this 2014 pick now before you go make a free agent splash? You know, so just something I thought about. What's your opinion?
Yeah, well you know, it's the funny thing about that is when you think about that pick that the Thunder got, for instance. It was first of all, the protection on it was weird. It's guaranteeing that would be a lottery pick, right?
Right.
But you know, you got to think they got that pick from Houston, who got it from Toronto in exchange for Kyle Lowry.
Right.
And so basically the bet there was Toronto said, "I bet you with Kyle Lowry we'll never miss the playoffs in the East," and Houston said, "I bet you will." And so they do that deal. Now Houston does the deal partially because, you know, it might turn into something of value, but the other part of it is, hey, one day we might have this opportunity to get a superstar, whoever it is. We can throw this in and it sounds really nice. It's a guaranteed lottery pick. So, you know, lo and behold, the opportunity came up in the Harden deal, and so you throw that in along with Jeremy Lamb, a nice young player, and Kevin Martin, a guy who can fill in that Harden scoring role. And it just, all those pieces fit to make a package that worked. You know, now it just so happens that, you know, Toronto ended up missing the playoffs anyway, but, it speaks to, it's always that gambling nature. You're basically betting on somebody's future.
Right, and I mean, the question I have for you is, we have seen a turnover this offseason unlike many that I'd seen in the past. I mean, we have playoff teams firing and hiring coaches. We have coaches being traded. We have front offices being cleaned out and replenished. We have, just movement all over the place in that area. From your experience, does it make it harder to pull off trades with the team when they have a new GM, or maybe they haven't even hired their coach yet, or they're in that process? I mean, we have a bunch of teams right now, some who don't have a coach, others who just within the last week hired a GM. Now we're going into this draft and off season. Do you find it that makes trades more likely or less likely when we have this much movement in front offices?
Well, you know, it really does depend. A lot of times that movement is indicative of, you know, the previous regime and what's happened. What were the events that led up to the necessity of a regime change? And so you get the new guy, and sometimes he's jumping the gun to make a splash. You know, so sometimes it's a lot easier to work with those guys than the other guys who, you know, have some longevity and don't need to make any moves. Other times, again, it could work the opposite way, where you got guys that are reluctant to show themselves, particularly if this is their first time at the rodeo. They want to be taken advantage of, so kind of they go in the opposite. In order to make sure we don't get it taken advantage of, we just won't make any deals, unless they're just 100% no-brainers, which, I mean, right. That's not really the way to go, but, you know, for a lot of teams, that's how they approach it. So it really depends. I think the coaching part is a lot more, indicative. You know, teams are usually reluctant to do deals, you know, if they haven't had even someone waiting, basically, to take over those reins. Because the last thing you want to do is, If you're Doc Rivers at the Clippers and say, "Hey, good news, what happened?" we just traded for Rajon Rondo. Like, oh crap, I just left the, you know. So, you definitely don't want to jump the gun there. You want to make sure that your coach is the type of coach that can handle the personality coming by, has a skill set that fits the coach's style. You know, I think about Minnesota drafting two point guards, you know, and then going and hiring a triangle offense coach where the point guard, you know, where the ball never sticks in one guy's hands for that long. You know, that's a prime example of doing it the wrong way. You know, even if Johnny Flynn was really good, him sucking aside, even if he was really good, you know, they basically brought a coach that, you know, doesn't fit the system. It would be like hiring Mike D'Antoni and not having a good pick and roll point guard. It's just, so why did you hire Mike D'Antoni then? You know, so I think coaching definitely weighs a lot harder than, or a lot more than the front office, how new they are.
So then jump into the coaching. I just want to get your take on this because every year, every single coach says the words at some point, we want to get out and run more. Everybody wants to do that because that's easy transition points, right? Well, Monty Williams has now had two seasons where he is rock bottom pace-wise for the whatever roster, whether he had Chris Paul or not, he's always been rock bottom. What you know the Pelicans, is Monty Williams ever going to be a fast team, or is it just he a half-court kind of guy?
I think he's a half-court kind of guy. I think you got to look at, you know, where he sprang from. You know, he was in Portland with Nate, and Nate did the same thing, you know. And, you know, you can't expect him to play fast and up-tempo any more than you can expect, you know, Mike D'Antoni, again, to play a slow pace, half-court, slow-down game, even though that's what the Lakers did. But they didn't look particularly great at it. So
right.
You're always going to coach to your strength. And if your formative experience was doing it a certain way, unless you're a basketball savant, and there are guys like that. So Larry Brown is supposedly a guy like that. You tell him what offense you want to run, and you can just hit the ground running and be able to run it and do it exactly how you ask. But unless you're that level of genius, you're going to basically do what you're comfortable with. It's like a player. You're going to revert back to what comes naturally to you. I think the important thing is also to realize that fast and up-tempo does not necessarily mean good or better. It all depends on your personnel. The problem, I would say, with the Pelicans is that you played slow and the efficiencies are still terrible. That's a problem. Like, you know, we damn sure better be like one of the top 10 defensive teams if we're going to play this slow. You know?
All right.
But, you know, fast or slow, I think, you know, fans want to see fast. Fans, because it's exciting, transition, running and dunking, and all. Fans are always going to want fast. But, you know, much like a kid that doesn't want to eat his vegetables, you know, fans, what they really love more, and they don't know it, I think, is wins. They want to see you win. And, you know, being as poor defensively as the Pelicans/Hornets have been recently, that's a lot more damning than, you know, we're slow and boring.
Mm-hmm. So there seems to be two philosophies with Pelicans fans. I want to get your take on this because you have pretty interesting philosophies about foundations of a team and how you go about building them. You know, one philosophy is we're a small market team. We just watched the Oklahoma City Thunder do this. Let's just be bad for a couple years. We hopefully have our Durant and Anthony Davis, a guy who could be a top 5 player in the league in his prime. Let's tank a couple more years, especially in this 2014 draft. And then you have others who look more at, a San Antonio model where the hope would be that, you know, Eric Gordon gets healthy, where Ryan Anderson plays as well as he does. Maybe you could go get a couple more quality free agents this year, build some kind of foundation, and then just work in Danny Green type pieces, or maybe you're drafting at 15, but the guys play like their top five picks because they're not asked to do too much. Those seems to be the two prevailing kind of philosophies of the ideal way to build the Pelicans moving forward. If you're in the GM seat, if you're in the decision maker, you know, which one of those two philosophies, or maybe a third, would you lean towards?
You know, first of all, I always go back to, you know, one of our coaches, he's in Cleveland now, Coach Igor Kokoschkov. You know, one of his favorite things is don't disrespect the game. I think, you know, first of all, when people talk about Oklahoma City and what they did, they never bring up any other example. Ever notice that?
Oh, I do.
What did the Oklahoma City thing? Okay. Who else has done it? A lot of teams. Who else has been good at it? Oklahoma City. Okay. So that, there's a reason for that. Second of all, I think what they did is not the same as what a lot of these other teams are doing or have done. What they did was they stripped it down, and then everything from that point was an attempt to improve the team. So they drafted Durant and Jeff Green. They didn't tank that next year. They just didn't happen to be very good. They didn't avoid being good. This is what they were. And then they got Westbrook, and they were a little better. And then they got, you know, Harden, and then they were a lot better. And then it starts rolling. Now, obviously, it's always easy when you start with Durant to get better every year. But I think the danger becomes from teams that you want to press the pause. Excuse me. You want to press the pause button. Right? Like, oh, let's not get good yet. 2014 is coming. You can't do it that way. Do you have a chance to get better? You got to get better. Because there's so many ripple effects from tanking, from being bad on purpose. You create an expert. First of all, the players know this. They know it. They know. They talk. They have friends. Hey, what happened, man? I thought you were coming. Oh, yeah, man, I know, but you guys shut down the deal, you know? So they know when they're not being serious. Or, you know, when miraculously after February, the rotations change. Yeah, we'll give Kendall Marshall some more run. You know, like, it's not a secret, you know? Everyone knows it. They can feel it. Like, someone who doesn't deserve to play is starting to play now. And someone who's done nothing wrong is now not playing at all. So, you know, you can't do that, I think. You know, and again, like, there's a lot of teams that have done. I mean, it's gone back. Think about Chicago. You know, 1998, you win a championship, and then, you know, they outsmarted themselves and say, well, you know, Michael may or may not come back. Well, let's just tear it down now and get ready for 2000, right? You know, 2000 comes, and everyone basically turns their nose at Chicago. So then they're bad for another, you know, 3-4 years. So what was supposed to be a 2-year hiatus turned into 6 years before they started getting good again. You know, so like I said, you know, it affects the culture of your locker room. And if, you know, your coach probably isn't going to be on board with it, because even if he has assurances, quote unquote assurances, that he's safe, at the end of the day, that's what his record is going to say. So his next job, someday they're going to look, your win percentage is only 495. Well, yeah, but that was because 3 years in New Orleans, we were tanking. Well, no one wants to hear that, you know, so that doesn't help there either. And then, you know, finally, I think players don't want to go somewhere where they've been losing unless it's, you know, it was temporary, right? You know, you don't want to, like, think about it. Charlotte's going to have cap space. How many free agents do you think are going to seriously consider going to Charlotte? Atlanta has cap space. How many free agents are going to consider going to Atlanta? I think Atlanta has a better chance than Charlotte, even though they're similarly located cities with similar kind of weather and, you know, similar demographics and all that stuff. But I think there's a big part of it is, you know, well, Atlanta hasn't been terrible for 5 years. Right. Charlotte has, right? So specific about New Orleans, I think you guys kind of already played that game, right? That's how you got Anthony Davis. And you played it again because you got a 6 pick this year. It's time to stop playing that game because now you're playing with fire. I don't know if Eric Gordon is part of that future, but you have pieces now that, you know, they're worthwhile. You want these guys now to learn how to start winning. you know, whether it's Anthony Davis, whether it's Vasquez, whether Aminu is a guy that comes back, you know, Ryan Anderson is a guy coming into his own. You don't want that loser mentality to just settle in. You don't want these guys to get used to it. You know, I think Anthony Davis lost more games this year than he did his entire life, pickup games included.
Right.
That wears on you, man. Like, that's not easy. It's not easy to just kind of shut off. Oh, next year's another year. No, these guys really carry that stuff over. So I can't just, you know, here's the good news. I don't think there's much you guys can do that'll get you good enough to play yourself out of a 2014 really good pick, other than trading the pick itself. But you know, to purposefully kind of avoid being good, I don't think that's a strategy to go after.
Couldn't agree with you more on that. My last thing that I have for you is we saw, I mean, we just watched, to me, my favorite finals since 1993. I mean, I just absolutely love this finals. Wish that we were playing a game 8, a game 9 this week. But what we saw is right before game 7, the analytics community came out, said, look, you can't have LeBron and Wade on the court together. Wade is killing the Heat. Old school basketball fans said, how could you even think about it? You have your best players on the floor. It feels like we're seeing a lot of this in front offices with coaches. You know, how is this heavy analytics? I mean, I know analytics has always been used in basketball, but this more heavy focus on analytics versus the old school guys. How is this playing out in actuality? And take me to your best guess 10 years from now. What are we looking at as far as what type of people are making the decisions in basketball? Is it always going to be a blend of the two, or do you think it's going to become way more analytic heavy?
Well, as far as the struggle or whatever you want to call it, I don't think it's as pronounced as people make it out to seem. I think there are teams that use analytics very well, and then there are teams that use it incorrectly or too much, or and then there are teams that don't use it at all and you know, are resistant to it. I think inherently it's always about using the best information. And I think smart decision makers and smart coaches are going to use the best information available to them. At the same time, you know, it's tough sometimes to give up on things that have brought you success. So in the Dwayne Wade example, if you're Eric Spoelstra, it's not so much that I don't trust analytics. It's as much as this is my guy. When I've called upon him in the past, he has responded. When I've needed, when times look dark and it looked like nothing could save us, he came through for us. How can I now, in the most crucial moment of the season, sit him? Part of that is, how can I do that? Because he's come up for me so many times in the past. And part of it also is, you know, if I sit him and we lose, how am I going to be able to look at this guy in the eye tomorrow and next year? He's under contract for a few years. I mean, so there's a lot more to it sometimes than just what the numbers say. There's a lot more to it than that. Now, like I said, are there some coaches who are more resistant than others? Absolutely. But I think, you know, for me particularly, you know, we got around that by attaching stats to video. So we wouldn't just say, oh, you know, we're minus 45 whenever LeBron and Wade are on the court together. We bring the video. Like, these are all their minutes together. And then we're going to see, oh, LeBron's really hesitant. Oh, you know, Dwayne is too aggressive for probably his level of talent at this point in his career. Oh, Dwayne doesn't guard anybody on the three-point line. You know, these are you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to get a desired reaction, right? Don't play LeBron and Wade at the same time. Does it matter whether it's because the plus minus says this, or whether whether the video says it, so much as the result is what we want, right? At the same time, you know, I just think a lot of fans and a lot of media types, they like to blow it up more than it really is as far as an issue. It's not that as big an issue as I think for most teams. Because, again, it's all about being able to communicate those ideals. As far as the second question goes, where is it going 10 years from now? So this is the question I'm always excited for when I talk on these things. Sports View and the Sports View data, the optical data tracking cameras set up in 15 out of 30 NBA arenas, this is the future. We're going to look at box score stats as like just the most rudimentary, like the caveman kind of little club or rock. And this thing is like a Ferrari. It's so far beyond our comprehension. You know, the best way I can describe it is it can answer questions that our brains can't even dream of right now. That's how powerful this stuff is. And it ends every single statistical argument, like Sean Marion grabs rebounds because he's cannibalizing from his teammates, or you know, Bruce Bowen is a shutdown. All of these questions that we say, you know, who's the best perimeter defender in the league? You know, all these questions are just going to fall on the wayside because we're going to have concrete answers to all of this stuff. I don't know if you guys got a chance to read the Zach Lowe opus on Grantland about what the Raptors are doing.
Yeah, any time that Ryan has a chance to read anything that says Rudy Gay is not doing something right, we're all...
I'm all over it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's frightening. You know, when I read that thing, I was frightened. Not because of what they're doing, but because of, A, the things that they're doing that they didn't feel comfortable enough to share. Because, you know, this was just the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
You know, and to the listeners who don't know what we're talking about, Zach Lowe wrote a great article, kind of a feature piece about how the Raptors are using the Sports View data. And in it, they basically designed a software program that tracks graphically, like on a play diagram, what all the players are doing on offense and what all the players are doing on defense. And then they superimpose what the players on defense should be doing according to what the coaching philosophy is. So then they can see how far off guys are from where they should have been, you know, and how slow they were to react. And all those things that we kind of talk about as coaches, you know, theoretically, like, okay, Rudy, you're late. You need to be all the way over here by the time he gets the ball. Now we can show it graphically, show how far off he was, you know, and measure those things and actually know the lag time on a guy's rotations or how far off he is off his trajectory, you know, on average over the course of a season. So this is what they decided to reveal to the world. So, you know, like an iceberg, 80% of that is below the surface that they're not showing us.
Right.
And then the other part of it is, even with that whole iceberg, there is literally an ocean of other icebergs that have not been discovered that even the Raptors don't know about. That's where Sports View is going. In 10 years from now, hopefully we'll have, you know, 30 out of 30 arena or 29 out of 29 arenas. Sorry, Staples. And all have this data and collecting it, because that's the other problem we have now is the sample size is too small. So, you know, for some players, we only have like 20 possessions or however many. So 10 years from now, hopefully we'll have years and years and years of lots of data points, so that we can start asking these questions that'll breed answers that'll make us ask more questions and so on and so forth.
Yep, and then we'll all be out of a job because nobody will need analysis when we have concrete answers. So,
well, you know, that someone asked me that the other day. It's like, well, is it just going to become like a software program since we know all the answers, how to guard a pick and roll? And I said, no, because at the end of the day, this league always comes down to execution. You can draw up the greatest scheme in the world. So you got a guy who can't execute, one guy can mess up the whole thing. You know, think about the Spurs and And the Heat in game six, you know, LeBron misses a three and then they give up an offensive rebound. And, you know, if you watch the replay, Danny Green's a guy guarding LeBron, contested the first three great, and then he starts to wander up court. He starts to leak. And I'm thinking, what are you leaking for? You grab a rebound, this game's over. You don't need a fast break layup or anything like that. As he leaks, LeBron starts to drift to the left wing. Danny Green doesn't follow him. LeBron catches the second, you know, second attempt, puts it up, three ball. Good. You know, in that case, you know, the Spurs might have had the perfect diagram for, you know, how to combat this Heat play. But unless Danny Green stays stuck to LeBron, you know, that scheme never has a chance to survive. And as long as you got players, and I don't want to pick on Danny Green, I like him as a player. I think that was just an unfortunate momentary lapse. But as long as you have human beings playing this game, there are always going to be momentary lapses. There are always going to be these slight kind of divergence off what the scripted path was. And that's where amazing happens.
That's a whole lot of information. Thanks so much for coming on. I mean, I think it's going to be an exciting draft because it could go any number of ways. It was great to kind of pick your brain about it, and want to say congrats. Amin and his wife are expecting their third child tomorrow.
Second and third. We're having twins tomorrow.
Oh my gosh! So. Congrats on that. Thanks so much for taking the time out. I know our listeners will appreciate it. Please follow them. Plug anything. We sent out your Twitter to our followers, but anything else where people could read you or see you or tweet you?
Yeah, well, you know, the main way to get in touch with me would be at ESPN. You know, I try to do a good job of responding to almost everybody that sends a message to me with a serious question. you know, you can find my work at, if you go to ESPN.com and search Amin El Hassan, or just Amin, really. I think usually I'm the first one that pops up. You know, you can see all my work there. And True Hoop TV sometimes. I don't know. We'll see. I haven't been on in a while, so I don't know if I should plug that one anymore.
I'll have to talk to Henry about it.
Yeah.
All right, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot, guys.